Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, excused, Boone, Minnis, excused for business of the House, Berger, Esquivel, Buckley, Hunt, Rosenbaum, Roblin, Thatcher.
Pledge of Allegiance will be led by Representative Jeff Barker.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
This morning, the opening ceremony will be presented by Lawson Inada, Oregon State Poet Laureate from Medford, reading a poem, and he is a guest of Representative Carolyn Tomei.
How wonderful to be here this morning and see the kids in the audience. In this house, what appears to be may not be what it seems. In this house, there appears to be the decor and decorum of a formal setting. In this house, there appears to be only designated persons participating in proceedings. But in this house exists another reality, a reality in the minds of every representative. For in this house, the minds of representatives are connected by conscience to respective constituencies. In this house, then, are many districts each with its own collective characteristics. In this house, then, are rivers, trees, grasses, fragrances that frequent the state of Oregon. In this house, then, are highways and intersections, sounds of traffic sustaining the commerce of Oregon. In this house, then, is our composite population, working, playing, worshiping, elders, families, children. This very house, then, is our expansive home, built on the past to oversee the future.
Thank you very much for sharing that poem with us. Courtesies, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it has been a real pleasure today to welcome Lawson Inada, Oregon's poet laureate. Lawson Inada was an emeritus professor of writing at Southern Oregon University in Ashland. He is the author of 5 books, Legends from Camp, Drawing the Line, In This Great Land of Freedom, Just Into Nations, and Before the War. Mr. Inada is a third-generation Japanese-American and raised in Fresno, California. In his autobiographical volume, Legends from Camp, he wrote about his boyhood experience of internment during World War II. He is the editor of 3 important volumes, including the acclaimed Only What We Could Carry, The Japanese-American Internment Experience. On 2 previous occasions, Professor Inada won poetry fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, and his work has appeared in the Best American Poetry. He is also a contributing editor for the Northwest Review and was a narrator for the PBS specials on Children of the Camps and Conscience and Constitution. Colleagues, I can't say enough how wonderful it is to have this acclaimed author with us today. Again, he is Oregon's Poet Laureate. Thank you and welcome, Lawson Inada. Thank you so much. Please welcome again and extend courtesies to our Poet Laureate.
Further courtesies, Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to recognize the honorary page today. Eileen Hinkle, if you'd stand up. Eileen is from Corvallis. Her parents, Mary and Peter Hinkle. She's age 16. She's in the 11th grade. She attends Marist High School. And some of her interests, she's on the school debate team and part of the National Honor Society. She belongs to the Marist Volunteer Program. She loves to draw. And having some discussion with her, it sounds like she's interested in the CIA. I'm trying to persuade her maybe to go into forensics with the state police. Anyways, welcome her.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is my great privilege today to recognize 2 honorary pages who attend Marist High School in Eugene. The first is Thomas Singel, who is the whose parents are Larry and Shelley Singel. He is, as you might guess, a football player, plays basketball, part of the Marist Volunteer Program. He also loves acting, singing, and playing the piano. He enjoys history and economics, and ultimately he wants to own his own business, be an economist, or an ambassador. I think I'll introduce him to Representative Lim. The other honorary page I'd like to introduce today is Jonathan Shivers from Eugene. His father is James Shivers. He also attends Marist High School. He's on the school debate team, member of the National Honor Society, and enjoys track. He says he likes to throw javelin. Unfortunately, with his foot in a cast today, he's not doing that right now. He wants to be a lawyer or go into politics. Living in my district, I think I need to be worried. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to introduce four honorary pages today coming to us from Marist High School in North Eugene, the district that I represent. Marist High School has a beautiful campus along the Willamette River and adjacent to one of our famous bike paths, and it's on the route where I will be picking blackberries next August. Marist High School is in a great location. I'd like to introduce first Kevin Walters. Kevin loves lacrosse and plays the piano. His career goal is to be a corporate lawyer. Emery Hillis is involved in cross country and track, and her career goal is to be a teacher. Ashley Elder participates in soccer and golf and is involved in the Marist Volunteer Program. She would like to be a nurse or go into business for herself. And Caroline Phillips belongs to the Marist dance team and the Marist Volunteer Program, enjoys playing lacrosse, track, and soccer, and wants to be a doctor involved in international health. An impressive group of young people. Welcome to the Capitol.
Representative Patty Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I have the privilege of introducing to you on my left is the 2007 Hood River Blossom Princesses. And I know earlier in this session I introduced the 2006 Hood River Blossom Princesses, but these are the new reigning princesses. All four come from families that are currently growing fruit in the Hood River Valley. And if you've never been to the Hood River Valley, you have to go when the pears are blooming, and it's a wonderful sight. First, I'd like to introduce Rachel Mallon. Rachel is a junior at Hood River Valley High School and is currently enrolled in three AP classes. She's a member of the National Honor Society, the French Club, and the Leaders for Tomorrow, sponsored by the Hood River Chamber of Commerce. She participates in soccer, basketball, track, and volunteers at FISH once a week. Rachel isn't sure what she wants to major in after graduation, but she's most interested in biology and would like to attend a private four-year college in the Northwest. Next is Jessica Goh. Jessica is a junior also at Hood River Valley High School with a 3.8 GPA. She's a member of the National Honor Society and the Hood River Chamber of Commerce Leaders for Tomorrow. She plays basketball and volleyball, enjoys four-wheeling and snowmobiling. She has a job with a Cascade Pet Camp in Odell, Oregon, and helps out in her parents' orchard. After graduation from high school, Jessica wants to attend Oregon State University and major in elementary education. Next is Rochelle Packer. Rochelle is a junior at Hood River Valley High School, is the vice president of her FFA chapter, and was awarded her state FFA degree this year. She shows cattle, swine, and horses in FFA and has her own herd of Angus cattle. Good girl. She is also a member of the equestrian team. Rochelle loves to ride her quarter horses for trail riding and barrel racing. In her spare time, she helps out with her family's fruit stand and orchard, and after high school plans to attend Oregon State University to major in some sort of agricultural field and Spanish. Next is Ashley McNerney. Ashley is a junior at Hood River Valley High School, where she's a member of the equestrian team and active in two 4-H clubs. In her spare time, she helps out in the family orchard, which produces pears, cherries, peaches, nectarines, and next year, blueberries. This is an amazing group of young ladies, and they're joined by Linda Gray, who is here with them. They come to the Capitol every year, and I extend courtesies to them.
It's wonderful to have you all with us. Welcome. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to welcome Madeline Brennan, who is serving as an honorary page today. She is an eighth grader at Ackerman Middle School in Canby. She participates in track, basketball, baseball, football, and soccer. She also likes drawing and video games. Her career goal is to become a civil engineer. Please join me in welcoming Madeline to the Capitol today. Thank you.
Further courtesies. Messages from the governor.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the Governor of Reform that he has approved to sign the following bills, House Bill 2071 and 2072. Messages from the Senate. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President of Reform that the Senate has passed Senate Bills 571, 5540, 5544, 30, 151, 620, concurred in House amendments, and repassed SCR 10 and 501. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President of Reform that he signed House Bills 5014, 5040, 2080, 2086, 2088, 2090, 2098, 2099, 2100, 2102, 2116, 2119, 2133, 2138, 2176, 2188, 2238, 2264, 2275, 2293, 2300, 2309, 2314, 2371, 2468, 2520, 2630, 2633, 2751, 2792, 2925, 2973, 3043, HCR 12. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President for Indigenous Science and Bills 81, 88, 95, 531, and 586.
First reading, memorials and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Representative Scott. For what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request rules be suspended and Republicans be allowed to caucus for about 10-15 minutes.
Representative Scott requests that rules be suspended for purposes of a Republican caucus for 15 minutes. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Democrats will also caucus.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, we stand in recess for 15 minutes.
Berger, Fire, Fire Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Bruin Buckley, Burley, Butler, Butler Cameron, Cameron Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Dingfelder Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Flores Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gelzer Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Jensen Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Rosenbaum Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Greg Smith Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Beyer, Bruin, Butler, Cameron, Dingfelder, Flores, Gelzer, Jensen, Rosenbaum, Greg Smith, excused, Minnis, excused for business of the House, 1, Nolan.
Colleagues, when we recessed, we were under special committee reports. We'll now close that out. Special orders of business. Clerk, read the bill.
Senate Bill 838 relating to electricity and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 838C. Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you Senate Bill 838, the Oregon Renewable Energy Act. This act is Oregon's landmark effort to decrease our reliance on fossil fuels, generate rural jobs, and protect our natural resources more wisely. At its core, Senate Bill 838 will have Oregon generating 25% of its electricity from renewable resources by the year 2025. It is an ambitious standard to meet, but Oregon is an ambitious state, and it is a standard that we can meet. As you already know, colleagues, this is a complex bill that sets a long-term direction for our energy policy. This bill is about taking control of Oregon's energy future and using homegrown renewable resources to do so. By cutting our reliance on imported fossil fuels, we stabilize rates for consumers and businesses, we cut our global warming pollution, and we build a new 21st century economy that benefits communities statewide. Whether it's wind and solar energy in eastern Oregon, wave energy for coastal communities, biomass energy in forested communities, or manufacturing jobs in the Willamette Valley, a renewable energy future will benefit every Oregonian. This bill is the most important vote you will take this session to choose a renewable energy future for our state. Here is a summary of the major portions of the bill. The bill addresses five main areas. There's definitions of renewable energy, the standards and which entities have to meet these standards, how the standards can be met, effect on ratepayers, and energy conservation provisions in the bill. The types of sources defined as renewable energy in Senate Bill 838, Section 4, include biomass, including landfill gas, woody biomass, and spent pulping liquor, hydropower, wind, solar, wave, and tidal, and geothermal. The definition section is important, colleagues, because Oregon is unique in the U.S. for the abundant supply of diverse renewable energy sources that we have. Areas around the Columbia Gorge and in northeastern and southeastern Oregon have excellent wind sites. The Oregon coast has some of the best wave energy potential in the world. And all of Oregon has great solar potential. Even Oregon's rainiest places get more sun than Germany, the current world leader. Many parts of southern Oregon have excellent geothermal energy potential, and our forests are, of course, abundant in biomass material. The core of the bill is the renewable energy standard of 25% by 2025. But the standards phase in gradually, and smaller utilities have lower standards. Here's how it works, colleagues. Large utilities, defined as utilities with total electricity sales greater than 3% of the state electricity consumption, have to generate 25% of their electricity from new renewable energy sources by 2025. To get there, they meet the following interim targets, which is 5% by 2011, 15% by 2015, and 20% by 2020. These standards only apply to PGE, PacifiCorp, and the Eugene Water and Electric Board. The medium-sized utilities, defined as those with electricity sales between 1.5 and 3% of the state's electricity, have to meet a 10% target for new renewable energy by 2025. This is a change made in the House Energy and Environment Committee. Small utilities, those selling less than 1.5% of the state's electricity, have to meet a target of just 5% new renewable energy by 2025. Here's how the standards can be met. To provide flexibility for utilities and ensure there are cost-effective options available, the bill provides several different ways for utilities to meet those standards. A, build or buy their own renewable energy generating facility. B, buy renewable energy generated by a facility owned by someone else. C, buy tradable renewable energy certificates. And these are certificates that document that someone produced electricity from a renewable source, and they can be used even if the electricity itself cannot be physically moved to the utility's customers. D, make alternative compliance payments. If cost-effective options are not available, the utility can put aside an alternative compliance payment, which can either be used to buy renewable energy when the energy is more cost-effective or be invested in energy efficiency or conservation programs. And E, co-ops, PUDs, and municipal utilities can comply with the standard by investing money in research and development of renewable technologies. This is an important benefit to our coastal utilities, which are already investing in wave technology. So a question I've had often from many of my colleagues is, what are the potential effects on ratepayers? First, colleagues, let me say that renewable energy is a good deal for ratepayers. Even if it is slightly more expensive, it stabilizes rates in the long run. Wind power currently comes with a 20-year fixed-price contract, a rate guarantee that no fossil fuel will provide. and it's not always more expensive. Utilities in Washington and Colorado have saved millions of dollars for ratepayers because wind power turned out to be the cheapest available energy source. In fact, in the other 22 states that have renewable energy standards, none have experienced significant rate increases. But of course, renewable energy can be more expensive, and as a long-time advocate for consumers, I can tell you that this bill has very strong protections for ratepayers. First, there's a cost cap. If complying with the standard would cause utility costs to rise more than 4% higher than they would otherwise, the utility does not have to comply. Costs are a very close proxy for rates, and the Public Utility Commission first determines the utility's cost and then converts that number into rates. So this is an effective cap on rate increases. Second, the bill allows for alternative compliance payments. If buying renewable energy is more expensive but does not trigger the cost cap, the utility can make alternative compliance payments, setting aside money to invest in renewable energy when it is more cost-effective or investing it in energy efficiency and conservation. Hydropower is protected. While old renewable energy resources of any type don't count towards the new renewable energy requirements, special provisions in the bill protect Oregon's access to low-cost Bonneville hydropower. No utility is required to displace the low-cost hydropower granted to them by the Bonneville Power Administration. Let me also talk here about the rate-making process and how utilities can recover the cost of their investments. Senate Bill 838 provides for utilities to use what is called an automatic adjustment clause. You've heard a lot about that, colleagues. But let me tell you, as the Public Utility Commission has stated, there is nothing automatic about an automatic adjustment clause. Utilities have to go through the exact same procedures and are held to the exact same standard of review for prudently incurred costs. The only difference the automatic adjustment clause makes is that utilities can apply to the PUC for recovery of their costs just on a particular renewable energy investment made for compliance of this bill, rather than having the company's entire costs reviewed. My committee added provisions adopted with a bipartisan vote to clarify that ratepayers will have access to the same hearings, discovery rights, and other procedures that they do in any rate review. Why is the adjustment clause in the bill then? Utilities tend to wait several years before filing for rate increases under general rate review procedures. Because coal and gas plants tend to come in very large increments on the order of 500 or 600 megawatts and take years to build, there will be a general rate review around the times these plants go online. But renewable energy come in smaller increments, about 100 megawatts, and are added more often. So a utility may be waiting years to recover its costs. Timely recovery is actually good news for ratepayers. Colleagues, the ambitious effort outlined in Senate Bill 838 is nothing new for Oregonians. We have long been known for our stalwart commitment to smart strategies which protect our natural resources. But we are not the first this time. 22 other states have already enacted renewable energy standards. In Oregon, we don't generally wait for other states to take the lead, nor do we wait for a federal solution. When presented with a problem, we act. And this is the great tradition of our state. Well, we're presented with a problem now. We're dependent on highly limited resources for generating the power we need. And our reliance on fossil fuels means rates are rising as the price of coal and natural gas increases. As our population grows, the need for more and more energy will mean higher and higher rates. And our reliance on fossil fuels means we are dependent on out-of-state and foreign energy sources since Oregon has no fuel production of our own. These resources, we have abundant renewable energy resources, which puts us in a unique position compared to other states. There are moments when we as legislators make choices about the long-term direction of our states. And colleagues, this is one of those moments. By acting today, we choose to use our own homegrown resources to take control of our future, to build our rural economies on a sustainable foundation, and to capture these benefits in ways that will also benefit our environment. Today, and together, we can choose a stronger, brighter energy future.
Further discussion, Representative Shuffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill, please.
To the bill.
Yeah, I just feel I have to do a little splaining around here today. I really want to give a lot of credit to the good chair for all the work she's done on this. I have been an avid supporter of renewable energy in this state and at this desk. I was the only one on the conference committee for the biofuels package last session that was willing to vote for that package with a pollution control tax credit added into it, a watered-down tax credit, or no pollution control tax credit at all. I was the only one of the five people on that conference committee that was of that mind. I support all her efforts on biofuels to help us become energy independent, especially get off the yoke of foreign oil in this country, and to help our rural economies thrive, who have been devastated because of the locking up of natural resources, not only in this state, but across this country. And I do want to thank her for the fixes that she did do to help the co-op and PUD electric generators out in the rural areas and here in some urban areas as well. Me personally, I have my electric bill upstairs. For years, my wife and I have chosen to pay extra on our electric bill that goes into investment for green sources of energy. I'm one of 6% of ratepayers across the state that made that choice. I think we could have done more to encourage and just flat out let people know that that option's out there, especially up where I'm from. Stabilizing rates in the long run. You know, I hope she's right. I hope my friend from Portland is right. But, you know, from what I've seen in energy in my lifetime, that is impossible to predict, no matter where the energy comes from. The damn hydroelectric system we have on the Columbia River, when it was sold, said we would eventually have free energy in this country. It would be free. Well, we all know that certainly has not come to be, as much as I do support that system and encourage more of it, to be quite frank with you. A few things all we really had to do to get 55, maybe 60 people on this floor to vote yes. And these are the reasons why I will be voting no. The A-30 amendments, all that would have meant was that the same exact rate review process would go into place when adding on to pay for these new systems. I spoke to a representative from one of the investor-owned utilities yesterday, and he was talking, I brought up the word automatic adjustment clause. If it's not automatic, take it out of the language. To say it's not automatic, yet have the automatic in the language, is an absurdity that the vast majority of the people that pay our wages here will not understand and will not like. But I was talking about that, and he went on to tell me about the new wind energy investments that are being made out east, which I've toured and completely support. And he said, when we, meaning the investor-owned utility, build a new system like that, we go in and request a rate review and a rate increase to pay for the system. And they get it, and he said, we're already going in that direction anyway. And I said, that's precisely why we don't need this bill. We are going in this direction. We have spent countless hours in the preparedness, Oceanic Policy Committee, which I sit on, talking about wave energy here in this state. So, and then the last one, and then I'll sit down, the woody biomass definition. I really think this could have been easily handled. We easily could have done this. You could have got probably close to, if not unanimity, on this floor. But unfortunately, that's not the case. I do not think this is a bad bill. I think this is a good bill. I think this is going in this direction is the right direction. I support my friend from Portland in her efforts, her valiant efforts and struggle ever since she's been in this building to get clean air, clean water, and local energy and get us off the yoke of foreign oil, which I completely support completely. But I cannot today, in all good conscience, vote for this bill. Thank you very much.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, right now, a mile off the coast of Reedsport, the waves are swelling. And at this very moment near Pendleton, the wind is blowing. And in the Klamath region, not far beneath the Earth's surface, 220-degree water is bubbling. In Ontario, Baker, Burns, and Bend, and, well, Salem, the sun is shining. Oregon's natural resources contain enough energy capacity to meet every current and future power need imaginable. And yet, at this moment, our state imports energy, including from coal-fired power plants in Wyoming, Utah, and Montana. And over the next several years, Oregon's utilities will be making critical decisions about where to invest millions of additional dollars to keep up with the state's energy needs. This renewable energy standard represents a golden opportunity to increase the likelihood that those dollars are spent here, developing Oregon's natural resources, developing Oregon businesses, and creating Oregon jobs. This bill is about taking control of our energy destiny, taking it away from energy traders in LA and Houston, and putting local entrepreneurs and local workers in charge. And this, colleagues, is only the third best reason to support Senate Bill 838. So let me talk for a minute about everybody's favorite subject, global warming. I think we're reluctant to talk about this because as individuals, it feels like there's very little we can do. And even if we band together and act as a state, well, we're still a very small state in a small corner of the world, faced with the reality that we can only make a very little dent in this problem. But the alternative, colleagues, is not to act. And we know that for Oregon, inaction will mean increased forest fires, water shortages, and health risks. It will mean higher sea levels and increased erosion, all of which are likely to cause untold economic and environmental damage. And I don't want to dwell on these risks, and I'm not going to do that now, but I do want you to know, colleagues, that when I'm up at night thinking about the future of the child that I'm about to help bring into the world, it is these issues, more than any other that we're dealing with this session, that keep me up with worry. So I'm willing to gamble on that little dent that we can make. And I've got to believe that there are others out there who are going to make dents of their own, and that collectively legislation like 838 around the country and around the world will deal a blow to greenhouse gas emissions. And that, colleagues, is only the second best reason to support Senate Bill 838. The single best reason to support Senate Bill 838 is because it points us towards an economy and culture in this state that will be necessary for us to effectively respond to challenges facing health care, public safety, education, the environment, indeed to more effectively govern ourselves as a state. And what am I talking about? Let's look back a minute at Oregon history. There was a time where the primary reason for the existence of Oregon cities was to do the shipping, the financing, the trading, and the manufacturing for Oregon's natural resource economy. A majority of Oregonians living in cities in my district had a connection to the land through their employment, and even if they didn't work for a company that was involved in those processes, they knew their livelihood was affected to a great degree on what happened in rural Oregon. They had a stake in rural Oregon. And unfortunately, this is no longer the case. Many of the ties that once bound this state have been severed. Oregon's urban economy is more connected to swings in Silicon Valley and Wall Street than it is to Mill City and Newport. And that matters, because when we lose those ties, it becomes a lot more difficult for us, including this institution, to find middle ground. To be quite frank, I have a hard time explaining the need for compromise to my urban constituents who lack ties to rural Oregon. Now, a renewable energy standard isn't going to solve this problem on its own, but join with me, please, in imagining a future where more than a quarter of the energy that heats and lights the homes of my constituents comes from windmills in the Columbia Basin, from solar arrays in Wheeler County, from geothermal energy in Lakeview, from biomass from our forests, and wave energy off our coasts. Imagine that Oregon's universities and companies lead the world in the research and development of new and better renewable technologies. Imagine that companies like PV Powered and Idatech and Bend and Solar World and Hillsboro and many others are industry leaders in the manufacturing of renewable technology. Imagine the connections that this scenario would recreate between people in very different parts of the state.
Representative Boquist yields.
Now, we have with this bill the opportunity to restore some of those economic ties, and with them the cultural, social, and political ties that follow. Nothing, I submit, nothing could be more critical to meeting squarely the extraordinary challenges that face our increasingly complex and vast society, challenges that include not only global warming, but making sure people are healthy, making sure food reaches our tables, and that new technologies are used appropriately and ethically. This, colleagues, is the very best reason to support Senate Bill 838. I urge your aye vote.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is going to be a rare time in the history of the floor. I think representative from Happy Valley used all 5 minutes, and I probably will do the same. Question for the carrier?
Question. Representative, once you have made comments to the bill, you cannot ask a question. Point of order raised by Representative Richardson. Please go ahead and state your point.
I'd like to challenge that ruling, since he made no comments to the bill, but merely was making a parenthetical comment as he stood up about time. He never said to the bill, never spoke on the bill.
It is our custom and practice that once one begins speaking without referring a question to another carrier, that the clock begins, and the underlying assumption is that you're speaking to the bill, even if your comment is parenthetical. This is a situation where we thank you, Representative Hunt.
Mr. Speaker, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended so Representative Girard may be allowed to ask questions on this questions of the carrier on this bill.
Representative Hunt,
and then have his 5 minutes of debate.
Ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Representative Girard to proceed to ask questions and then take his 5 minutes for discussion of the bill. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead and ask your question. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
She does.
First of all, I hope I don't screw things up here, but I'd like to thank the body for allowing me to do this. Question would be, why is the definition of woody debris in Senate Bill 838 different from the one passed last session in Senate Bill 1072, which became ORS 526.277, and also different from the definition that is part of the renewable energy resource definition in ORS 469.185, and doesn't it exclude most woody biomass from qualifying as renewable energy?
Thank you, Representative, for that question. I think you meant woody biomass instead of woody debris, but I will address that. First of all, the biomass component that counts towards the renewable energy standard includes organic waste products, spent pulping liquor, woody debris, agricultural waste, dedicated energy crops, and landfill gas. I don't read the woody biomass definition as being very restrictive. It was written in a way to keep it consistent with the definition contained in House Bill 2210. This was the biofuels legislation that passed out of the chamber earlier and out of my committee, and is consistent with the Department of Forestry, which has a definition for biomass projects to thin the forest, restore forest health, and reduce wildfire risk. Assured by a letter from Department of Energy Director Mike Graney that the definition of biomass in Senate Bill 838 is appropriate for new biomass facilities in the state, including those fueled by woody debris, and that no new or existing facility that otherwise meets the requirements of this bill in Oregon would not qualify towards the standard in the bill.
Thank you for that answer. Question to carrier?
Additional question of carrier. Does carrier yield?
Yes.
Carrier yields.
Wouldn't the Public Utility Commission be bound to follow the language in SB 838 rather than the language in other statutes unless we amend Senate Bill 838 to be the same as those other definitions?
Mr. Speaker, I will repeat what I had said before, that it was written in a way to keep it consistent with the definition contained in House Bill 2210, and this was already a different definition from Senate Bill 1072. So we're going to have two different definitions no matter what this bill says.
Okay. Final question for the carrier?
A final question for the carrier. Does the carrier yield? She does.
Yes, in my district we have four hydroelectric dams. Could you tell me what the problem is with additional hydroelectric and why that isn't included in the definition, especially if it's in non-migratory fish areas?
Thank you for that question. Actually, hydropower is included in the bill. If you look at page 2, line 41, the bill declares hydropower as an important renewable energy source. And then on page 3, starting at line 42, hydropower is listed right there along with the other renewable energy resources. Hydropower also has the same start date as other renewable energy resources, as you can see on page 2, line 45, and it goes on to the next page. Senate Bill 838 actually gives hydropower special inclusion that no other resource has. On page 6, starting at line 44, utilities cannot be required to displace preference power they receive from BPA to comply with the Renewable Portfolio Standard. So if a utility is 90% hydropower, then their standard can never be more than 10%. On page 4, line 5, hydropower is designated as the only resource for which projects older than 1995 can count. Utilities can count up to 50 megawatts from older hydro projects. And in committee, we actually broadened this exclusion to clarify that upgraded facilities do not have to be outside of protected areas. On page 4, line 3, efficiency upgrades on existing hydroelectric facilities count towards the renewable energy standard. And on page 3, starting at line 44, new hydroelectric projects built outside of protected areas, such as wild and scenic rivers, count towards the standard. And this was an amendment that the good representative from Bend had submitted to the committee.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, for woody biomass, the Senate Bill 838 definition counts as renewable energy only electricity generated from woody debris from harvesting or thinning conducted to improve ecological health and to reduce uncharacteristic stands, replacing wildfire risks. This restrictive definition appears to exclude electricity generated from woody biomass from commercial timber harvest activities on state and private lands, the source of over 90% of Oregon's annual timber harvest volume. Worse yet, also excluded in electricity generated from mill waste, the primary fuel source for most woody biomass energy facilities. The SB 838 definition could disqualify most electricity generated from woody biomass in Oregon from counting towards RPS goals, which make no sense. Amending Senate Bill 838 to include a reasonable definition of woody debris is simple. Woody biomass has already been defined in ORS 526.277 by last session's bipartisan Senate Bill 1072. Material from trees, and this is a quote from the definition, material from trees and woody plants, including limbs, tops, needles, leaves, and other woody parts grown in a forest, woodland, farm, rangeland, wildland, urban interface environment that is the byproduct of forest management, ecosystem restoration, or hazardous fuel reduction treatment. The definition makes sound policy sense and should be a definition adopted in 838. Now, the reason it's important in my district is, and we heard about Mill City, well, down the road a little bit from Mill City is the town of Lyons. First Lumber Company, who employs 425 people, just laid down $22 million to build a new biomass electricity plant that's going to generate 10 megawatts of firm, reliable electricity, which would be enough to provide for 5,400 homes. The fuel source for this power plant will be 500 truckloads per month of bark purchased from mills and ground up urban wood, otherwise destined for landfills. Using the current definition of woody biomass in Senate Bill 838, most of the electricity generated by the plant using this fuel source would not qualify as renewable energy. Proponents of the bill have argued that the definition provides only an example of what would qualify, and it doesn't intend to exclude other woody biomass. If that is indeed the case, and the definition is meaningless, why then is it part of the bill? And since it is confusing and in conflict with existing law, why do the proponents object to changing it to a more accurate and well-settled definition? Let's not leave the forest sector out in the cold. please join me in voting no on Senate Bill 838. And once again, I want to thank the body for allowing me to ask the question. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Burley.
Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does carrier yield?
Yes, they do.
Carrier yields.
Thank you. Why is the date for qualifying facilities in the bill January 1, 1995?
Thank you to the good representative from Ben for that excellent question. Senate Bill 838 is about where we want to go, not where we've been. And we need to ensure that utilities are making investments in new renewable facilities, not taking credit for investments that are 20, 30, 40 years old. The Governor's Renewable Energy Work Group, which I served as a member, and I know you attended many of those meetings, settled on the 1995 date as a good compromise between recognizing utilities like the Eugene Water and Electric Board that were early in investing in renewable energy without going back so far as to defeat the purpose of having the renewable portfolio standard in place. No matter where you draw the line, it's a somewhat arbitrary choice, and there will always be projects on the other side of it. It's unfortunate that we can't accommodate everyone, but it's also a fairer policy than starting the clock at an effective date of this act when many Oregon utilities have been investing in renewable energy already.
Further question?
Additional question of the carrier. Does Carrie yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. Excuse me. On page 8, lines 18 through 23, the bill says that utilities, quote, are not required to comply, end quote, if the cost exceeds 4%. Now, if the bill in its current form provides adequate consumer protections, why is this 4% cost cap discretionary? Why does it not say that the utilities shall not comply if the cost exceeds 4%?
The bill uses that language for one simple reason, colleagues. We are setting a cap on how much utilities can be required to spend, and how much rates could therefore increase as they comply with the renewable energy standard. This is a protection that consumers do not have for fossil fuels whose prices have increased dramatically in the last decade. If fossil fuel prices keep escalating, the cheapest resources for ratepayers in a given year might be a renewable resource, and forbidding utilities from buying the cheapest available resource because it happens to be a renewable resource that would comply with the standard would be a bad policy for ratepayers.
Further question?
Further question for the carrier. Does carrier yield?
I do.
Carrier yields.
Thank you. Assuming the 4% cost cap is triggered each year for the next 15 years, how much would that cost the two investor-owned utilities over the 15-year period?
To clarify, colleagues, the 4% cost cap is a safety net or a release valve. No other state has seen any significant cost increases, and this is 22 other states that have adopted a renewable portfolio standard. But based on your scenario, doing some math that I looked at last night, over 15 years, the two utilities that are in the higher standard for the bill would collect about $41 billion in rates, and as much as $1.6 billion could be spent on renewable energy. However, a study that was done by the Berkeley Renewable Energy Lab found that for the majority of renewable energy standards, rate impacts are expected to fall between a 1% increase and a 1% savings for ratepayers. Based on that study, the more likely impact in your scenario would be that if $41 billion was collected in rates, Oregon would somehow they would see about a $400 million rate savings and a $400 million cost increase. And remember, colleagues, money spent on renewable energy is investment in Oregon's sustainable economy rather than out-of-state coal plants.
Follow up.
Additional question, is Carrie Yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. If I understood your answer correctly, I believe you said $1.6 billion would be the additional cost if we had 4% trigger for 15 years.
Possibly. Potential.
My question is, if that $1.6 billion is passed on to the ratepayers, what would that equate to in a percent increase in the rate?
Over 15 years, it would equate to a 4% rate increase. But I assume that what you're getting at is that a cost cap is not a rate cap, and if theoretically cost did actually increase 4% over what they would otherwise be, rates could again theoretically rise slightly higher. That's simply because the PUC accounts for depreciation, and so a higher proportion of a utility investment is allocated to rates in the early years. But higher rates early on would be offset by lower rates later. So over 15 years, the rate impact would be about 4%.
Okay. And a final question.
A final question. Are the care? Does the care yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. Proponents have said that this is a huge shot in the arm for often struggling rural economies. Let's take a look. Let's take, for example, a $100 million wind farm. We're going to invest $100 million, build a wind farm somewhere in one of the eastern counties. How many long-term family wage jobs will that $100 million investment create?
Thank you for that excellent question. The average Northwest wind farm produces about 200 construction jobs and about a dozen long-term jobs. The extraordinary benefit that wind farms bring to rural counties is in other economic development. Farmers can earn revenue that they need in order to keep farming their land, and farmers are earning between $7,000 and $14,000 per wind turbine on land that would otherwise generate about $100 in wheat. And they can keep farming right up to the base of the tower. Even more important, with our rural counties struggling in the face of lost federal revenue and the property in property tax revenue, this is money that will come into the counties. Right now, wind farms are providing 10% of Sherman County's revenue, and a new wind farm that could start operation soon is expected to add another 20%. Union County is expecting $10 million in revenue from a planned wind farm there. That is why, colleagues, you will find in your bill files letters representing Union, Sherman, Wasco, Wheeler, Gilliam, Harney, and Hood River counties, and a separate letter from the sheriffs of Union, Umatilla, Gilliam, Sherman, Wasco, and Morrow counties.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want to thank, first of all, the many, many, many people that worked on this policy, both during the interim and during the session, the folks on the Renewable Energy Working Group, my colleagues on the Energy and Environment Committee. It's a fascinating piece of policy. It truly is. Renewable energy as a whole is fascinating. Something we should be doing. And perhaps more than anybody in this chamber, I've got businesses, I have manufacturers in my district that make this equipment, I've got contractors that install this equipment. I want to promote renewable energy. I want to vote for this bill, but I can't, and I'll tell you why here in a moment. But I do also want to thank the chair and others, because we did get some amendments in last week to deal with the consumer-owned utilities, to address some issues we had with the automatic adjustment clause. Earlier, we had some amendments put in on an issue that I brought up, I found in the bill, dealing with small, low-impact certified hydro projects, and I appreciate that very much. But we're not quite there. We're on the 10-yard line. We only got to go 10 more yards to get this thing across the goal line, and I'd like to ask your help in sending this back to committee to get two more amendments in here, the 2% rate cap and one dealing with the qualifying facilities, and I'll discuss that in a moment. Why do we need a renewable portfolio standard in the first place? Proponents say we need it to make utilities develop or require renewable energy. Why, you may ask, are the utilities not doing that now? The answer is very simple, and you've heard it. Renewable energy costs more money. It costs more money. Wind power is the only one that is almost cost competitive right now. At times it is, depending upon the price of natural gas. But I want to point out that wind power is not a firm power. By its very nature, it's problematic. In fact, over the weekend, the Oregonian had a story about last summer's heat wave and the effect that had on electricity in the Northwest, California included. And in that article, if you noticed, They said that all of the wind power that had been developed was of no help at all during that energy crisis. Why? Because when you got these huge high-pressure systems parked over the Great Basin area, the wind's not blowing. So it's of no help. All of that notwithstanding, we need to move forward with this for all the right reasons. Hydro, which is not included, wind, biomass, landfill gas, all these things need to be developed. But colleagues, here's my big concern. Mr. Speaker, permission to use visual aids.
President Burley asks for unanimous consent to use a visual aid. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you. I've got some newspaper headlines here. March 21, Oregonian. Cost of renewable energy bill unknown for Oregon ratepayers. The article says, even as Oregon legislators consider a bill that would force utilities to get one quarter of the electricity they sell from renewable resources, they have little definitive information about the issue that likely concerns ratepayers most. What is it going to cost? No one, it turns out, knows for sure. Oregonian, May 22. Court rulings jolt the region's investor-owned utilities, and 75% of Oregon ratepayers will feel the shock. This is referring to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision over BPA's residential exchange program. Also, May 22, Oregonian. The court decision would increase monthly bills for most residents by 13% beginning next month. That's June 1st, next week. Today, Medford Mail Tribune. Suspension of BPA credit will raise Rogue Valley residential costs 13.1%. That's my concern, folks. We don't have the ratepayer protection measures in this bill that my amendment would do, a 2% rate cap. We have a 4% cost cap. That is the limit that the utilities may spend, not shall spend. But that does not translate. That is not a percent-to-percent translation. 1% cost is not a 1% rate increase. And we have asked repeatedly, what's it going to cost? The press has asked, what's it going to cost? We don't know. All I'm asking for with this amendment is a 2% rate cap.
Representative Butler yields.
Thank you, Representative Butler. It's a backstop, folks. It's simply a backstop. I'm not challenging the nucleus of this policy. I don't want to touch the 25-by-25 mandate. Okay? I just want to have a backstop for the ratepayers because I'm very concerned. Minnesota. And by the way, I think there's now 23 states, I believe, that's adopted RPS standards. In February, Minnesota adopted a renewable portfolio standard. And I want to read to you from the bill, Minnesota bill, Senate Bill 4, I believe is what it was. Quote, the commission shall modify or delay the implementation of a standard obligation in whole or in part if the commission determines it is in the public interest to do so. The commission must consider, and please pay attention to this, the commission must consider the impact of implementing the standard on a customer's utility costs, including the economic and competitive pressure on the utility's customers. Colleagues, Minnesota got it right. They told the commission that they have to look at the impact on the rates. And furthermore, they have to look at the effect that has on the economic and competitive ability of their business sector. Now, I've been working with a coalition of ratepayers on this bill that collectively represents a huge part of Oregon's manufacturing sector, and hence a lot of jobs. And they are very concerned about this. They don't want to kill this bill because they understand all the positive reasons to do this. But they want to have this rate cap. They want to have this backstop. They want some certainty that the prices aren't going to go through the roof. Colleagues, these are manufacturing jobs. These are the types of jobs that we go to great lengths to promote in this state. And this bill, I'm concerned, may put some of them at risk. Now, the other issue about the qualifying facilities, and the reason I asked the good representative from Northeast Portland and Maywood Park about the January 1, 1995 date for qualifying facilities, is that in 1978, Congress passed the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, or PURPA. That bill was the catalyst for pioneers in the state of Oregon to develop low-impact renewable energy facilities, mostly biomass, some hydro, small-scale hydro. Those facilities have been operational now for two, 3 decades. Okay? Under this bill, they don't qualify. They don't qualify. And I think that's unfair. I think that those pioneers are being penalized simply because of some arbitrary cutoff date. And I'd like to see that fixed. Now, you want to talk about jobs and rural economies. Let me give you an example. In Prairie City, nice little town nestled at the base of Strawberry Mountains out east of John Day, there's a biomass cogen facility. I think it's 9.5 megawatts. Been operational now for 20-plus years. They employ about 75 people collectively at that facility in Prairie City. Now, you want to talk about jobs. 75 jobs in Prairie City, Grant County, equates to about 15,000 jobs in a metro area. That's a huge number. That's a big part of that rural community. And I was told last month that that cogen facility is currently shut down. And they want to see an RPS because they think that'll help them market their power. But even if we pass this bill, that facility in Prairie City would not qualify under this bill. So it would do them no good. None. So colleagues, again, I'm going to ask you one last time. Please send this bill back to committee.
Representative Thatcher yields.
Thank you, Representative. Please send this back to committee so we can get these amendments in here, bring it back to this floor, and we can all declare victory. Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, Senate Bill 838 is regarded as being an environmental bill, and it certainly is that, but it is also an economic development bill. Oregon produces almost no fossil fuel, but it has potential and current sources of renewable energy in abundance, whether you're talking wind, biomass, solar, wave action, and next generation hydro. It's all here. So Senate Bill 838 is saying, let's buy here in Oregon from our farmers and from our timber owners and other producers of renewables. Senate Bill 838 is an economic development bill in another key way as well. Oregon is becoming a center for renewable energy research and business activity. Economists have identified the importance of clustering in economic development as a strategy, and Oregon is becoming a key location for a cluster surrounding development of renewables. This investment in new energy sources will draw people here with PhDs. Their creative talent, whether it's in a lab in Corvallis or a high-rise in Portland's Pearl District, will take Oregon forward into the next century. And these people earn good incomes. Those incomes get spent on homes, on groceries, on all the goods and services that they need to live a good life here in our state. In our Energy and Environment Committee, we learned that energy is not governed by free market forces. Rather, it is a highly regulated market in which we make choices. The new choice is now before us. That is, will we continue to rely on coal and on old generation hydro, or will we embrace new renewable sources of energy? The right choice is to embrace the new renewables and to vote yes on Senate Bill 838. Thank you.
Representative Greg Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my soliloquy with you. Colleagues, what a grand opportunity we have today. What a grand opportunity we have for District 57, for the wonderful counties of Union and Wallowa, Morrow and Umatilla. We have a grand opportunity today for consumers. I'll explain why in a moment. We have a grand opportunity to assist our and help out our environment. We have a great opportunity to help business and industry, a great opportunity for all of rural Eastern Oregon. I want to applaud and personally compliment my visionary colleague from Northeast Portland in Maywood Park. I salute you. I want to thank the good representative from Bend for the true leadership that he has provided on this very, very important piece of legislation. Each and every one of them have worked so hard day in and day out. Investment, jobs, stability, renewable, earth-friendly, these are all words that we can use to describe Senate Bill 838. I want you to know, since October 2005, more than $1.4 billion have been invested in rural Oregon counties. It's been absolutely fabulous. In Union County, which is the center and the heart of District 57, the largest single investment in that county's history is underway. And it's as a result of the anticipation of passage of Senate Bill 838. But colleagues, sometimes our honor as a House of Representatives must come before all the financial gain that could be had from Senate Bill 838. It's my belief, up until just a short time ago, that the integrity of this chamber was in jeopardy. You see, a long time ago, a promise was made in this state. An agreement was universally understood. And colleagues, if you'll just indulge me a little bit with just a tad bit of corniness, I want you to take a look up there at that beautiful mural. Citizens of differing views coming together and compromising, finding common ground, reaching agreement, and knowing that when their word was given, it was their bond. It was as good as any contract. Let me tell you why I'm sharing this with you. Since the 1930s and into the 40s and the 50s, during that amazing time of rural electrification in Oregon, many electric co-ops were founded. Oregon communities, as part of this new direction, were directed to create locally elected, locally responsible, and locally liable boards of directors to manage the distribution of power throughout regions that they created. Our communities accepted this challenge, and they accepted it wholeheartedly. And I have to tell you, over the last 70 years, there's been some really good times for electric cooperatives, and there's been some really bad times. Rural partners, and I call each and every one of you that today, you've helped hold the integrity of that agreement intact. I was worried about that up until a couple weeks ago when rural electric cooperatives were under attack as a result of Senate Bill 838. But today, if you read Section 7 of the bill, our rural electric cooperatives have been exempted out. A good bill, in my mind, has been made even better. Colleagues, I don't know what the price of energy is going to be in the future. I don't know if it's going to go up and up or down. I don't know if our ratepayers are going to be dramatically impacted to the negative as a result of Senate Bill 838. But what I do know is a tremendous amount of investment is coming into District 57, and my ratepayers are protected. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
President Flores yields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, you've heard a lot of good things that we all agree upon that this this bill does. It's great environmental policy, provides great jobs and investment for my colleague in the rural county, may even protect his ratepayers. So that's good news. For certain areas of our state, it's great news. But for other industries, small commercial operations, hotels, restaurants, retailers, this bill doesn't do much to protect them. And I began today to talk about that. We heard about the need for a rate cap. I began to rise and talk about the small businesses that I so dearly have a passion for and represent. But my mind went further than that. I think of the benevolence programs that even at our business at Cafe Today, the times I've written checks for employees. Probably the biggest area that we do in advance, no interest, sometimes even just pay it, is for that employee's utility bill. Not too long ago, right here, I think Representative Clem and I got to experience hundreds and hundreds of people standing around a facility right down here on State Street, waiting for credits, for vouchers, so that they could keep their electricity on. I've heard today that, yes, rates might go higher earlier and lower later. I've never seen that in my lifetime. And I guess I rise today not about the small commercial businesses, because they'll figure it out. They'll eventually get in through the mix of their product mix. They'll cut labor costs, or they'll cut something else someplace else to help offset the rising cost of utilities. But unless we fix this bill, that line down the street of people waiting to pay their little electricity bills who are served by these two publicly held utility companies will only go up. And I am supportive of all the good stuff we're doing. Last week I looked at an electric car. Why did I do that? Because the price of energy is going crazy. I'm investigating wind power, solar power from my house. Great. Why? Because the market's driving it. But we need to be very, very careful. We need to make good policy here to protect those citizens, many of which don't even vote to send us here. But they're still the citizens in the district. And I urge you to send this back and to put those provisions in to guard those citizens that pay those rates.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Dingfelder, do you wish to close?
I would, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. I'd like to address a couple of the issues that came up during some of the floor speeches here that weren't asked during the questions. First of all, I would like to emphasize again in response to why the committee did not adopt the 2% rate cap. Colleagues, the 2% rate cap does not provide the ratepayer protection that it sounds like it would. That's why the bill contains a cost cap instead. First, the way the amendment was drafted would have allowed a 2% rate increase every year. The 4% cost cap already in the bill is an absolute cap, and that means an absolute cap for costs, which are proxy for rates, and this can never be higher than 4% above what they would be otherwise. It's not an additional 4% every year. Unlike the proposed rate cap, and I want this to be clear, the cost cap does not aggregate annually. It's over the life of the bill. Second, the limit on a rate increase per year actually hurts ratepayers. Arbitrary rate caps can actually drive up costs because they can act as a disincentive for making cost-effective investments. That's because a utility can't take advantage of uniquely inexpensive renewable resources in one year by investing in enough renewable energy resources to meet the targets ahead of time. They would hit the lower rate cap and then wait until the next year before they can invest more. The second issue I'd like to address that also came up is about the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on BPA's residential exchange and how that potentially will cause residential rates to go up about 13%. Colleagues, the recent court decision is indeed bad news for ratepayers. I will be one of those as a Pacific Core ratepayer. As a result of this lawsuit, and was supported by members of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, among others, most residential ratepayers in Oregon will now have to pay up to 13% more for energy for the immediate future. To me, this decision simply emphasizes that we are over-reliant on a large energy system outside of our control. Renewable energy is a way for Oregon to develop homegrown resources and take control of our energy future. As I mentioned before, renewable energy like wind and solar provide a real rate stability. It's the only resource that comes with a 20-year fixed-priced contract. So this bill, again, just as a reminder, does provide full protection for ratepayers, including the cost cap, which I've talked about quite frequently, the alternative compliance payments, low-cost hydropower is protected, and the bill provides multiple levels of certainty that the PUC will apply throughout the standards and procedures of rate review to any utility request to recover costs in rates. In closing, I would like to say what I think this bill is really about. It's about a vision and a tradition. Vision because it requires us to think about what we want our state to look like in 20 years. And tradition, because by passing this bill, we will be continuing Oregon's legacy of actively planning for the future. In 20 years, colleagues, do we want a state that is even more dependent on out-of-state coal and foreign natural gas? Do we want our economy to rely on energy sources whose prices will be increasingly volatile? Do we want California, Washington, Nevada, and Montana to reap the benefits from investing in renewable energy technologies while we're left behind? And do we want to leave our children to struggle with the consequences of catastrophic climate change? I think the answer is no. Oregonians have a different vision for the future. We realize that our state is uniquely positioned to capitalize on emerging energy technologies. Wind energy from the Columbia Gorge, wave energy from the coast, geothermal energy from southern Oregon, and biomass energy from our forests, and solar energy across the entire state. Colleagues, every corner of our state has the potential to benefit from renewable energy technologies. Passing Senate Bill 838 will help make this happen. I ask you to join me in endorsing this vision for the future of our state, and I ask for your aye vote on Senate Bill 838. And I respectfully request a call of the House.
Hold on just a moment. Representative Jensen, for our purpose to your eyes.
Mr. Speaker, I need to declare a conflict of interest.
Please go ahead and state it for the record.
Yes, for the record, we have family interest in a corn farm in Iowa, which this should help.
Duly noted for the record. Representative Greg Smith, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I also need to declare a potential conflict of interest.
Please go ahead and state it for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a significant financial interest in a company
that potentially may do business with beneficiaries of Senate Bill 838.
Your potential conflict is duly noted. Representative Dingfelder asks for a call of the House. She is joining that request by Representative Greenlick, Representative Riley, Representative Shields, Representative Barker, and Representative Rosenbaum. The doorkeepers will bar the doors. Sergeant of Arms at 10, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Berger-Beyer. Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Boquist-Bruin. Buckley. Burley. Butler. Cameron. Cannon. Clem. Cowan. Gallum. Dingfelder. Chris Edwards. David Edwards. Esquivel. Flores. Galizio. Garrard. Gelzer. Gilliam. Gilman. Gerard. Greenlit. Hannah. Holvey. Hunt. Jensen. Conk. Kotek. Krieger. Crummel. Crummel Lim. McPherson. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nathanson. Nelson. Nolan. Nolan Olson. Reed. Richardson. Riley. Roblin. Rosenbaum. Schaffler. Scott. Shields. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Thatcher. Tomei. Wisnet. Witt. Mr. Speaker. Not answering. Berger. Boquist. Crummel. Nolan. Excused. Not subject to the call. 1 minute. All members are present. Those who believe that they Senate Bill 838C should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Flores, how do you vote? She votes no. Representative Berger, how do you vote? She votes aye. Representative Scott, how do you vote? He votes no. And Representative Jensen, how do you vote? He votes no. Senate Bill 838C, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Propositions and motions. Chair requests unanimous consent that consideration of Senate Bill 829 and Senate Bill 479 be made as special orders of business immediately following the order of business of Special Committee reports on Tuesday, May 29, 2007 calendar. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I move that House Bill 3429 be withdrawn from the House Committee on Judiciary.
Representative Wisnett moves that House Bill 3429 be removed from the Committee on Judiciary. Masons, Section 491.4, notes that it is not in order to discuss the merits of the bill upon a motion to withdraw the bill from committee. Debate in such cases must be confined strictly to the purpose of the motion. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, time is running out on this session to expand our fight against meth. According to the Portland Police Bureau, meth addicts commit 85% of property crime in Oregon. This problem won't end when we sunny die next month. This may be our final chance in 2007 to reduce Oregon's property crime rate. According to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, our property crime rate remains far above the national average. HB 3429 needs to be withdrawn today and debated soon because it toughens sentences for offenders who repeatedly engage in robbery, ID theft, and car theft. HB 3429 has not been granted a work session or public hearing in the House Judiciary Committee. Withdrawing this bill today gives us the opportunity to discuss this urgent issue. It allows us to debate the merits of cracking down on those who continually disregard our laws and repeatedly victimize our citizens. Colleagues, I've had a car broken in Northeast Portland. I've had a storage facility broken into in Deschutes County, and the officer said it was for meth users.
Representative, I think you're now wandering into the substance of the arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last session, we took a chance and became a leader among states in combating meth use with our passage of meth bills. Colleagues, let's keep on the offense in this war in our neighborhoods and withdraw HB 3420 and pass this important legislation. Please join me in voting to withdraw HB 3429 from the House Judiciary Committee and take advantage of our last chance this session to target property crime in Oregon. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the maker of the motion.
Yes, Mr.
Do you yield? He does.
Representative, looking at House Bill 3429, was there ever a request made to the chair of the committee for a hearing on this bill?
Thank you for the question, colleague. Good representative. No, sir.
Okay. Further question of the motion maker.
Further question. Do you yield?
Yes, sir.
He does.
Representative, are you aware of how many total bills were referred to the Judiciary Committee this session?
No, good colleague, I do not. I would like to know.
Thank you very much. To the motion.
To the motion.
Mr. Speaker, the answer to that question is in excess of 400 bills came to the Judiciary Committee. It has historically been the committee where the highest volume of activity occurs within the building. More bills move through the Judiciary Committee. More bills are referred to it every session. And while a great many bills, and I can't tell you exactly how many received a hearing, it was over 200 bills, but that there's a wide margin between the total number of bills that are referred to the committee and those that can actually be considered. And so as one sort of practical method of managing the workflow of the committee, as a chair of that committee, as a general matter, I waited for members to come forward and request a hearing on their bills. And this bill did not have any such request made on it before the deadline of April 30 that was set for consideration of bills in their first committee, and therefore no hearing was scheduled. Therefore, because no request was made, I think it's not appropriate now to be trying to pull that that bill out of committee. I would recommend a no vote on this motion.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I ask a question of the good representative from Lake Oswego?
Good representative from Lake Oswego, do you yield to a question?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. You make mention of the request to hear a bill. Do you have evidence of a request for every bill heard in that committee?
Representative, I receive requests both in writing and orally, and so I have no, of course, written record of the requests that are made to me orally. I'm going on recollection, and I didn't recall a request having been made on this bill, and when I asked my colleague who had was moving to be withdrawn from committee, his recollection appears to be the same as mine.
Follow-up?
Additional question? Does a good representative like us go yield?
I do.
He does.
Could it then be said, I'm wondering, could it then be said then that every bill you've heard in that committee may not have a record of requests to be heard?
Yes, I think it's accurate to say that I did not keep a record of each request that was made, and I was going by recollection here, and I think like all of us here, we have a lot of things coming at us all the time, and we make a written record of some and not of others.
To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, I think we've now cleared up an issue that requesting a committee chair to hear a bill is not necessarily imperative for important legislation to be heard. This is important, and I would urge your aye vote on this motion.
Representative Wisnett, do you wish to close on your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, this is a difficult process that we have here and very demanding, and I respect the chair and his efforts. However, House Bill 3429 says it's sponsored by Representative Wisnett. Obviously, I wanted this bill heard. I wanted it heard because it's important for you and me and the citizens of Oregon. I realize the difficulty of a chair has in scheduling events, although I was not involved in scheduling the workflow of that committee as vice chair. I do think this is a good bill. It's going to help protect your people. Crime property is a big problem, and I would ask you to vote for this bill. I did not know, I was never advised as a member of that committee, that we had to submit a letter to the chair asking our bills be heard. The chair did hear several of my bills, but this one is an important bill, and my name is there as the chief sponsor of this bill. I consider that a request to have a hearing. Thank you, colleagues.
Those are the opinion that House Bill 30... Representative Wisnett requests a call of the House. He has joined that request by Representative Hanna, Representative Dallum, Representative Gerard, Representative Gilman, excuse me, and Representative Nelson. Doorkeepers bar the door. Sergeant Arms 10, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Beyer Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Bruin. Buckley. Burley. Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hanna, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnett, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Beyer. Excuse, not subject to the call. 3, Boone, Clem, Minnis.
Representative Wisnett, what proofs do your eyes?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rescind the request for a call of the House.
Representative Wisnett moves to dispense with further proceedings on the call. This will not suspend the call, but direct the Sergeant-at-Arms to cease looking for absent members. House will remain on the call until the vote is taken on the motion pending. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Those of the opinion that House Bill 3429 should be withdrawn from the Committee on Judiciary will vote aye. Those opposed, no, and the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Hunt votes no. Representative Beyer is off the floor. All have now voted except for Representative Beyer, who is off the floor. So the motion, having failed to receive the required majority, fails. First reading of House bills. Second reading of House bills. Consent calendar. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended. The bills remain on today's consent calendar be carried over to their proper place on the Thursday, May 24, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Third reading of House bills. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended. The bills remaining on today's third reading of House bills calendar be carried over to their proper place on the Thursday, May 24, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Final reading, memorials and resolutions. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the table. First reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 5540, relating to financial administration, the Teacher Standards and Practice Commission, declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 5544, relating to financial administration, Oregon Youth Authority, appropriate money, declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 30, relating to destination resort siting, declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 151, relating to enterprise zone program and prescribing an effective date. Senate Bill 571, relating to smoking and prescribing an effective date. Senate Bill 623, relating to taxation.
Bills read first time or passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 117 relating to telephone solicitations, declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 133 relating to disclaimers. Senate Bill 303 relating to Garter Schmidt. Senate Bill 392 relating to school attendance. Senate Bill 462 relating to South Umpqua School District Number 19 and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 543 relating to property governed by declarations and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 590 relating to criminal impersonation. Senate Bill 806 relating to local budget law. Senate Bill 951 relating to pseudo voters and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 1002 relating to search and rescue. Senate Bill 1040 relating to stands with chronic illnesses and declaring an emergency.
Bills read second time or passed the third reading. Third reading of Senate bills. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that the bills remaining on today's third reading of Senate bills be carried over to their proper place on Thursday, May 24th, 2007 calendar. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House. Other business of the Senate. Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will give you a short quote from Othello. Here is my journey's end, here is my butt, and very sea mark of my utmost sail. The butt is the target, the place aimed at. The sea mark is a sign that the voyage has reached its farthest point. Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to announce that the Veterans Committee has completed its business for the 2007 session and is the first committee of the House of Representatives to close down.
And I am delighted to hear your announcement. Representative Hunt.
I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker. I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and Representative Nelson be allowed to change her vote on Senate Bill 838C. It will not affect the outcome.
As Representative Hunt asks for unanimous consent to allow Representative Nelson to vote on
838.
Change her vote on Senate Bill 838. Is there an objection? Hearing none. Representative Nelson, how do you vote? She votes aye. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee on Revenue has a lot more business to do, but we will commence our business this afternoon at 1:15.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request the rules be suspended and that Representative Riley be allowed to change his vote on 3429. It will not affect the outcome.
Representative Scott. As for the rules suspended, to allow Representative Riley to change his vote on the motion to withdraw House Bill 3429 from the Committee on Judiciary. Is there an objection? Hearing none, Representative Riley, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Dingfelder.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. The House Energy and Environment Committee will meet at 1:15 today.
Are there further announcements? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The House Committee on Consumer Protection will meet at 1:15. Thank you.
Further announcements? Remonstrances. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just wanted to make a comment about a comment that I made last week, and I've been waiting for the representative from Wilsonville to return, where I ask my representative from the heart of Tigard if he was relieved on a scale of 1 to 10 that the representative wasn't here. Colleagues, my mom is watching us. Is it the Oregon Channel? The Oregon Channel is on the air. And I asked my mom the other day how she thought I was doing, and she wasn't really interested in talking about me. I suggested that I had been up to talk about a number of things, and she was unimpressed. I asked her if she was impressed with her representation from Happy Valley. She said she was happy with it, but that's not what she wanted to talk about. She wanted to know that when I rise to speak, is right behind me with kind of the crew-cut, semi-gray hair. And I said, that's the representative from Wilsonville. Well, I didn't say that to my mom, but we have to say that here. And she said, that's the guy I like, because he's asking the questions. Thank goodness somebody's asking the questions. My point is just simply this. With television on and people watching, I don't get it in Silverton. I don't get that channel. I don't know if you get it in your districts. And a representative from Santa Ana doesn't have television, so he doesn't get it. But a lot of folks are watching. And my point is this. I know that we all get a little bit tired. We got the stack of bills we didn't get to. But people are watching, and they don't know what we know in committee. They haven't been through all of it. I thought today was a great example. We talked about a lot of things, a lot of tough things that went on and didn't go on in committee, and there was a lot of disagreement. We may be aware of that in caucus, but the folks watching on television aren't. And so when you pass a bill as important as renewable energy, it's a good thing to have debate. It's a good thing to ask questions. I asked a question early on and was told, you know, you don't ask a question unless you submit it ahead of time. Now, I respect that, and I respect the decorum, but sometimes things come up, and you ask questions. So I'm waiting for the box set of 74, the legislative session, because I don't get it. And I don't watch the show. But people are watching, and asking questions, no matter how tedious we may think they are, is a very, very important part of this debate. People may come up to your desk while you're giving a remonstrance and want to ask you a question. And that's how I'll close with these immortal words. Hi, Mom.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Governor Kulongoski proclaimed May the 25th as Missing Children Awareness Day. You can do your part in helping the rescue of these children. We know one's kidnapped every 40 seconds, and if their lives are lost, it's in the first 3 hours after their kidnapping. Well, we can all do our part by supporting Dalton's Law, House Bill 3176, that is over in the judiciary in the Senate. With that, we can
Find the vehicle, save a life. I urge you to urge the chair and the committee to hear this bill, House Bill 3176, as a further honor and respect to our governor's proclamation of Missing Children Awareness Day on Friday. Thank you for your support.
Adjournment. Representative Jensen, 10 a.m. Thursday, May 24, 2007.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House to adjourn until 10 a.m. Thursday, May 24, 2007.
President Jensen moves the House to adjourn until 10 a.m. Thursday, May 24, 2007. Without an objection, the House is adjourned.